An old fisherman is seen walking on a beach, and he was carrying a few fish in a bucket. Then the game warden walks up and asks him to see his fishing license. And the old man said, I don't have a fishing license. And the warden said, well, you know it's illegal to fish without a license, right? And the old man says, well, I wasn't fishing officer. These fish are my pets. And the game warden looked at him and said, your pets? Well, the old man said, well, yes, officer. They like a little exercise, so when the weather's fine, I take them out to the water and let them swim around. And once they're done, I give them a little whistle, and they jump back into the bucket, and then we head home. Well, the officer is not buying any of this, so the old man says, well, don't believe me? Just watch. And he tossed the fish back into the lake, and the warden waits for a minute, and he says, all right, now whistle your fish back and bring them back out of the water. And the old man says, what fish? Well, there are expectations are often very different. Today I am entitling this message, What is Required of Us? What is required of us? And if we want to put a little marker in the page for Micah 6:8, we're going to refer to that from time to time. What is required of us? We'll reference Micah 6:8. And so let's take a look at Micah 6:8, because it says, He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? Well, we're going to unpack this to understand the verse and all that it encompasses, but we must see what led up to the verse in the book of Micah. Micah, as we know, was a minor prophet. He was minor only in the sense of the size of his writing of the book, but not minor in the importance of his prophecy. According to the Abingdon Bible Commentary, Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah the prophet. Micah was from a rural village in the northern kingdom of Israel, whereas Isaiah was from a bigger city, Jerusalem, which was in the southern kingdom of Judah. And the kings of this time, meaning in the north, there's a list, Omri and Ahab, and then there was a series of shorter ruling kings. 6 months was one named Zechariah, a month was Shalom, 11 years was Menahem, Pekahiah, 2 years, and Pekah, 8 years, Hoshea, 9 years. It was a whole variety of kings during this time, but slowly, step by step, the nation of Israel became vassals, meaning under the control of a neighboring country called Assyria. Israel became militarily more weak and weaker and had to pay tribute or taxes to their enemy, Assyria, who now controlled them. And then about 750 BC, the prophet Amos sent a message that justice was important to God. If we read in Amos, in Amos 3:10, I'll try to pull that one up here. In Amos 3:10, Hosea, Joel, Amos. For they do not know to do right, says the Lord, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces. Ooh. So in other words, in high places, bad things were happening. We went through the list of the list of kings that they had gone through. And if we're in the same area in the Bible, in Amos 4, we read through verses 1 through 13. I'm going to read all of them. But it lists the reasons why God was unhappy with the northern kingdom of Israel. And he was explaining that justice was coming because they had abandoned God's law. So if you take a look and just, you can mark that one, but in Amos 4, verses 1 through 13, and it talks about all of the difficulties and the problems that resulted from that. In the book of Hosea, it's a story of patience. Hosea pointed out that God required love, but Hosea was repeatedly merciful to his wayward wife. And Hosea preached that God desired the quality of mercy to be displayed. that the spiritual qualities of mercy and understanding were even more important than conducting sacrifices. Of course, we take a look in Hosea 6:6 for that. And if you stop and think about it, mercy is pretty important because God had commanded sacrifices. So how much more did he expect mercy to be administered? In Hosea 6:6, "For I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." So he was putting it at a pretty high standard. Isaiah followed up by noting that God required holiness. Now, a lot of people don't think about what holiness is. And I thought, well, how do you define holiness? And the best definition I could come up with is holiness is means set apart for a special purpose by God. If we look at Isaiah 35 and verse 8, "A highway shall be there and a road, and it shall be called the highway of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for others. Whoever walks the road, although a fool, shall not go astray." In other words, there's hope if you're doing what God wants us to do. So, through Isaiah 35 and verse 8, and when we apply that, that's really a dual prophecy. He spoke of the way of holiness before the Lord, that the people of Judah and Israel should seek holiness, and those who didn't wouldn't be spared from the misery to come. So, it's a dual prophecy because it also refers to the kingdom of God, that we must seek and follow the way of holiness in order to enter God's kingdom. Well, by this time, it's around 750 BC, and the sins of both the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel were both beset by the same sins, and the prophets were warning them. And then along comes the prophet Micah. And if we look at Micah 3:11, he denounces rulers and priests and false prophets. He deplores the money-grubbing exploitation of the helpless, dishonesty in business, and sham religion. So if we look at Micah 3 and verse 11, we'll jump there. Hosea, Joel, Amos. There we go. In Micah 3:11, "Her heads judge for a bribe," meaning the rulers. "Her priests teach for pay, and her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord and say, 'Is not the Lord among us? No harm can come upon us.'" Well, what Micah was pointing out, a lot of that was a sham. That the rulers took bribes, and so did the priests, and so did the prophets. The entire society was not following God's ways. And yet, all of these, the rulers, the priests, and the prophets, they all claimed that God was with them, and that no evil would befall them because they had God on their side. Kind of look around at a present-day society, and do we have rulers who gather money to themselves? I can't help but note that politicians who are in office for a while all seem to be well-heeled on their way out of office. What about religious leaders? Just as in Micah's day, there were modern religious leaders who soiled their hands with money. Have you ever heard of a religious leader taking a paycheck, living on an expense account, and then somehow subverting the very organization that issued the paycheck and the expense check? We also see false prophets on television vigorously announcing the exact date and time of the end of the world, or what they call the rapture. Such false prophets reap millions of dollars of income by getting people to donate their life savings into supporting these kinds of false ministries. I had one person contact me through the church website, and we talked for a long time. He had suffered severe financial loss because he had donated most of his assets to an organization that was quite willing to take his money without regard to the fellow's well-being and left him bereft. In other words, the graphic pronouncement of Micah 3:11 applies just as much today as it did in ancient Israel and ancient Judah. Well, In carrying out his warning message to Israel and Judah, Micah combines the messages of the prophet Amos, which is about justice, and the prophet Hosea, which is about love and mercy, and the prophet Isaiah, who preached holiness or humility. And he put it into one verse. He combined those three other prophets into Micah 6:8, which we've read earlier. He's shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. You notice that Micah styled his statement in the form of a question, and then he answered his own question, sort of like a TV game show, Jeopardy, where the answer is given in the form of a question. Unfortunately, the message from Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah were not closely followed, and the entire northern kingdom of Israel suffered. In 722 BC, the Assyrians besieged Samaria, the northern capital of, or the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. A previous king, Omri, had spent a lot of time and money fortifying the walls of the city of Samaria. Because the walls were so big and strong, it took 3 years for the Assyrians to breach the walls of Samaria and destroy the city. We can only imagine the horror that became the people behind the walls during the three-year surge. And it was just 30 years since they had received that prophecy that the northern kingdom of Israel was no longer existing as an independent nation. So we've examined, looked at the history of Micah 6:8, to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Well, how do we then follow the admonishment of Micah and the other prophets? The Oklahoma comedian Will Rogers said it well, and you've heard me quote it before, and I will paraphrase his comment. Some people learn by reading, some people learn by observing others, and some people have to touch the electric fence for themselves. Well, the people in the prophet Micah's time didn't follow God's law, whether they learned of God's way in the form of reading the scriptures, or personally by observing what the results happened to those who failed to follow God. So they had to experience the bad results for themselves. Then, we now have the story of Israel and Judah, and it's written down for us to read and understand. So we can learn by reading and observing what happens to others. And reading Amos 4, verses 1 through 13 is really unsettling, because what's going to happen to those who refuse to obey God? The prophecies were intended for their whole society, not just the leaders, as well as our whole society today. We need not touch the electric fence for ourselves. So then we ask, well, what do we do here and now today? Let's take a look at Ecclesiastes 7:20. In Ecclesiastes 7:20, I'll find it. In Ecclesiastes 7:20, there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. Well, that's pretty scary, because we're required to be just. And what does that mean? Following God's law. In other words, we do it imperfectly. We try, but we're not perfect in what we're doing, but we're making an attempt. And so we're going to go through and answer the questions about what to do here and now. But we'll take a look at some of the just men, despite this, that no one was just, yet there are people in the Bible who are called just. So I would suggest to you that just is not the conclusion of the matter, it's the people who are going in that direction. If we take a look at Proverbs 29, verse 27, Psalm, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs 29, Proverbs 29, verse 7, we'll get there, verse 27. An unjust man is an abomination to the righteous, and he who is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. Ooh, well, that's interesting. The unjust man is an abomination to the righteous, and he who is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. The wicked just can't stand a righteous person. That's a problem. Well, if we take a look at that, we can compare that in our personal lives. Have you ever had a boss, knew you kept the Sabbath, so what did he do? He frustrated your work schedule regarding the Sabbath and the holy days. Or maybe he demeans you or criticizes your work in front of others, maybe kind of hoping you'll quit and he can replace you with somebody who doesn't keep God's law. Maybe you have coworkers who make life difficult. Maybe they make false reports about you or your work, or they make needling remarks to make life difficult. Or perhaps if you're a student and your teacher mocks God and you're sitting right there in front of it all, or a fellow student teases or makes an effort to frustrate or embarrass you. Perhaps it's a government bureaucrat who isn't in any hurry to accommodate you while you have limited time, perhaps on your lunch break, or if you've got to hurry to pick up a child after school, or whatever the circumstance might be. Their schedule is not your schedule, and if you don't like it, well, it's too bad. Perhaps it's the difficulty is from a neighbor who disrespects your property or your quiet well-being. Perhaps the neighbor has loud parties, loud music or noise at night, or maybe they have a nasty pet that leaves surprises on your lawn or damages your property or barks all hours of the day and night. Had a neighbor, Charlotte, she's moved away since, had only one human neighbor live next door, and her dogs were our watchdogs. The property came within 12 feet of our house, and then it was on the corner of the property. Somebody drive up, the dogs would bark. We would know it. We didn't have to feed the dogs. We didn't have veterinary care. We didn't have to worry about them at all. We just had the advantage. Somebody drove up, they could hear dogs barking, didn't want to get out of the car. But then there was a time when I did a favor for someone, and they wanted to know if they could park trucks on our property. They were repossessing a dozen trucks. It was my uncle who worked for a company repossessing trucks. They drove them over from Tahlequah. I said, we got to get them out of there. It's a bankruptcy deal. So can we park them at your place? Sure. Just come and park them, a whole row of trucks along the driveway. Dogs didn't like it, so they started barking. Charlotte calls us up and says, your trucks are making my dogs bark. You need to stop parking your trucks there so it doesn't upset my dogs. And I'm going, what? You know, that. So it was interesting. We got along with her. The trucks at some point moved, you know, got them moved off to their destination. But I mean, you have these strange circumstances that come up. Perhaps you have a driver in another car who's making life difficult on the highway, blocking your traffic, maybe following too close. Don't you love those tailgaters going 70 miles an hour at less than one car length behind you? Or they pull in front of you at the last moment and then cut across the lane and then exit the freeway, even though they could have gently done it some other way. Maybe in your life you've seen a purse snatcher or aware of somebody who was had experienced a carjacker at the company I worked at in Los Angeles. One of the office gals would take the deposits to the bank every day. And she went to the bank, but before she could get to the bank, as she was coming in, a carjacker or a robber pointed a gun at her through the window because, you know, they're heading to the bank, they must have money, and forced her to give it over there. And was way too much excitement for one day. And these things happen. Perhaps the difficulty is with graffiti spraying in the neighborhood on vehicles or on signs, on buildings. Maybe it's the neighborhood bully who may be threatening or beating up your kid or stealing their lunch money or whatever bullies do. And the list could go on and on and on. And if we sat down with a pencil and paper, we could probably come up with pages and pages of things that unjust people do. That the list is so long and has been going on for thousands of years that in Psalm 43, verse 1, we have the psalmist crying out to God for deliverance from the unjust man. In Psalm 43, verse 1, "Vindicate me, O God, and plead my cause against the ungodly nation. O deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man." Don't we all want to be delivered from the unjust man? Well, unjust men just don't happen once in a while. It's been constant throughout the last 6,000 years of recorded history. And if we just go back for the last, less than 100 years, we have the Cambodian dictator Pol Pot. He orchestrated the killing of 7 million of his own people as he forced the depopulation of cities and killed anybody in the country who had an education because they represented a threat. And after many years, his government was overthrown. And years later, he was found in hiding, and his own companions in his previous revolution are the ones that killed him. There's a book and a movie that describes the horror of that time called The Killing Fields. There's another unjust man that stands out in history in the last 100 years is Fidel Castro of Cuba. And he was a terrorist guerrilla leader who had been the Cuban dictator since 1959. He was born in 1926, same year as my dad, and he died in 2016. Well, that would have made him almost 90 years old. And people fled Cuba under him. In fact, there's a minister who sits on the Council of Elders, Mario Sigli. He and his parents, his dad was a doctor in Cuba, fled with the family and got them out safely and came to America. There was a Chilean dictator, Augusto Pinochet. He gained power in 1974 through his participation in the assassination of the previous leader, Allende. So one previous leader was assassinated. Now, my uncle-in-law, who worked for the CIA in Chile at the time, of course, he didn't say that out loud. He worked for the State Department. We only found out after his death it was CIA. He arranged that particular assassination. Under Pinochet's rule that followed it, you go from bad to worse, 30,000 people were tortured, 80,000 imprisoned, and about between 1,200 and 3,200 people were just killed outright. Many people simply disappeared under the brutal rule of Augusto Pinochet. Eventually, he fled to Spain, fought extradition to Britain, finally was sent back to Chile, where he died in 2006 at age 91. Mao Zedong, may have heard of him, communist dictator of China. He killed between 20 and 40 million of his own people from the Chinese Revolution of 1949 until he lived in 1976. He lived into his 80s. All of these evil men of history lived a long time. It was Joseph Stalin, the communist dictator of the Soviet Union, killed between 20 and 30 million of his own people. Now we can go back about 800 years to Tamerlane. He was a nomadic conqueror from ancient Central Asia in the 1200s. He killed upwards of 1 million people. When he would defeat a people, he would create pyramids of their heads, chop them off, and pile up heads of 100,000. Apparently it was too big to pile them more than 100,000, so he had multiple piles of 100,000 heads. The damage he did in 15 days in Delhi, India, it took them 100 years to recover. Another 100,000 died when he conquered Baghdad in Iraq, and he died at age 71 on his way to conquer China, going over the mountains, and got sick and got pneumonia. And there are many other unjust men through history. These are just remarkable people that made the history books. They took away people's lives and property. They tortured and maimed. They separated families, besmirched the innocent. And it doesn't seem right that those evil people would live for such a long time. Let's take a look at Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 15. In Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 15. Ecclesiastes 7:15, "All things I have seen in the days of my vanity, there is a just man that perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man that prolongs his life in his wickedness. So it appears in this verse that the opposite of a just man is a wicked man. So you've got just man on one side and a wicked man on the other. In other words, what direction are they going? And I've often wondered how certain evil people could manage to live so long and inflict so much misery on others. Well, we're learning that the way of man is the way of misery and death, and it's God's way that produces good fruit, and Satan's way that produces misery and death. Now, let's compare those wicked men, the unjust men of history, and look at some that the Bible refers to as just men. Now, bear in mind, we read earlier, there is no truly just man in the sense of perfection. But there are people that are headed that way, that are doing their best. In Genesis 6, verse 9, these are the generations of Noah. And Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations and walked with God. So Noah was the first one described as a just man. He was trying to do what he could do. He obeyed God. And he did so despite the obstacles before him. He was surrounded by unjust men. And what did he do? He persevered in building the ark. Now, there are folks right here with us and listening online that have been in the church for many years. They keep the faith. They're doing the best to follow God. And yet none of us can say that we've persevered as much as Noah. It took Noah 100 years to build the ark, which is a tremendous example of faith to follow God in what was clearly a wicked and turbulent society. The next person that we find that I'm putting down or listing, who was listed as a just man, is Joseph in Matthew 1, verse 19. In Matthew 1, verse 19, Joseph, the husband of Mary. Matthew 1, 19, then Joseph, her husband, meaning Mary, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privately. Well, what did Joseph do to be called a just man? He used wisdom and discretion, considering how to deal with a perplexing problem. During this period of betrothal or engagement to Mary, his future bride, she turned up pregnant. And Joseph practiced true respect and love by not desiring to make a public example of his future bride. If we're in Matthew 1:19, look at the very next verse, Matthew 1:20. And while he thought on these things, in other words, he didn't make a quick decision, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, you son of David, fear not to take to you Mary your wife, for that which is conceived of her in her is of the Holy Spirit. Joseph was not a man who was quick to anger. Why do you suppose he was selected to be the husband of Mary? The task before Joseph was great. He had to raise up a son unequaled in the history of man. In this case, the just man was slow to anger. He was careful and loving. The next example we have is in Mark 6:20, is John the Baptizer. John the Baptizer in Mark 6:20. It's interesting when we read this, Mark 6:20, for Herod feared John. Doesn't that sound odd that the king would fear a follower of Christ, indeed a cousin? What did we read on? Knowing that he was a just man and holy and observed him, and when he heard him, he did many things. And now it's quite interesting, as it says, and heard him gladly. In other words, just received him. Oh, sure, I'll hear what you have to say. So King Herod knew that John the Baptizer was a good man. And at the time that this verse was written, this was written after John the Baptizer's death. He was beheaded by King Herod. Herod knew that he had done wrong by having John the Baptizer beheaded. King Herod knew that John was a just man. Now, King Herod was genuinely concerned that John had risen from the dead. You see, this was after John was dead, but it was actually Jesus Christ, who was his cousin, who was now out and about teaching, preaching, and healing. And Herod was aware that Jesus, the Christ, was doing so and had heard him speak. And there had to have been a family resemblance between John the Baptist and his cousin, Jesus the Christ, because King Herod, with a guilty conscience, confused the two. In any event, Herod knew that the just man was before him, and a just man was of God, and that was the God who could raise someone from the dead. Had Herod a bit nervous. Well, let's read down now in Mark 6, 34. We're in Mark. Mark 6, 34. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved for compassion with them because they were like sheep, not having a shepherd. He began to teach them many things. You see, Jesus was busy and King Herod was confusing Jesus with John, thinking that this was a reincarnation or a resurrection of John the Baptizer, that the people were as a sheep not having a shepherd. In other words, this particular just man, John, had a heart and the actions of a shepherd to help the people who he was sent to serve. Another person who is described in the Bible in Acts 10:22 was a Roman soldier named Cornelius. In Acts 10:22, Cornelius is referred to here. Acts 10:22, and they said, Cornelius the centurion, a just man that feared God. And has a good reputation among all the nations of the Jews, was divinely instructed by a holy angel to summon you to his house to hear words from you. Well, this is really quite perplexing on the face of it. Here we have someone who is part of the occupying army, the Roman army, and yet he was well regarded by the people who his army was occupying. Now, the Bible uses a repetition as a form of emphasis. And often the same principle will be repeated using different words. In this case, in Acts 10:22, the term just man is immediately followed by two characteristics that describe what a just man is. The first one says, one who fears God. If we read back in 2 Samuel 23 in verse 3, 2 Samuel 23 in verse 3, if I can get back to it. 2 Samuel 23 in verse 3, the God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spoke to me, he who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. If we read on, then, in other words, a just man has to fear God. In other words, be in awe of God, have a respect for God. And then if we turn to Job 28, and Job 28, we'll find it. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, we're going to get there. Job 28, verse 28. And to the man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So we have this principle that if you're going to have a responsibility, as it here says in 2 Samuel, to rule over men, you have to do it with understanding the fear of God, and you must use wisdom. The fear of God is what? Wisdom. To depart from evil. In other words, don't do the wrong things, do the right things. The second characteristic back that Cornelius, they said about Cornelius, back in Acts 10:22, said he has a good report among the Jews. And this is really quite remarkable because he was an officer in the hated occupying Roman army. And yet he had developed a good rapport with the Jews. So let's understand the underlying principle. It's important to have a good relationship, even among those who would otherwise despise you. And Cornelius did that. The third characteristic about Cornelius in Acts 10:22, he was willing to listen to the words of God. Notice the last part of Acts 10:22, because what did he want? He wanted to hear the words of you, meaning of Jesus. He had a desire to hear the words of Jesus. And if we move on, in Acts 10, if we move on to verse 30, we can find more characteristics of this just man Cornelius. And we read Acts 10:30, he said, 4 days ago I was fasting to this hour, and the ninth hour I prayed in my house. Well, in one verse, we're told that Cornelius was fasting. Why would somebody fast? Because they're going to have a blood test taken tomorrow and they want to check their blood sugar? Doesn't say that. What was the purpose for fasting? Was to become close to God. And then he also said he prayed. So we have these characteristics of Cornelius, the just man. There's another mention of a just man in the Bible, and it's found in Matthew 27, verse 19. In Matthew 27, in verse 19, and in the final hours of the physical life of Jesus Christ, he was hauled before Pontius Pilate, a Roman governor, for a court hearing. And Pilate was the prefect or the ruler of the province of Judea under the Roman emperor. And Pilate reported to his boss, Caesar, the emperor Tiberius. And as such, Pilate had a job that was really a political hot potato. He had to keep the peace in his corner of the Roman Empire in order to extract as much tribute or taxes out of the people that he could. So he can push them just so far without having a wild rebellion, because they were there to milk it for as much as they could. So in Matthew 27, in verse 19, Matthew 27, verse 19, what have we got here? While he was sitting at the judgment seat, now this is Pontius Pilate's wife. While he was sitting in the judgment seat, his wife, meaning Pilate's wife, said to him, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I've suffered many things today in a dream because of him." Pilate's wife knew that Jesus was a just man, and she was warning her husband, "You got to be careful here. You don't want to, this is a hot potato. You really don't want to touch this one." And she was warning him not to have anything to do with this Jesus person. Pilate's wife was fearful. She was fearful of what would happen. And what did we find after that? Is that Pilate later washed his hands in public to demonstrate his attempt to be guiltless in the pending death of Jesus Christ. Now, let's take a look back. We started in Micah 6:8. There were three things there. The first one was to do justly. Well, we've covered some examples of unjust men and some just men. We're going to examine the Bible for some other characteristics of what does it mean to do justly. And we can take a look at the first thing to do justly is be willing to learn. Number one, be willing to learn. In Proverbs 9:9, give instruction to a wise man and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man and he will increase in learning. So a just man is willing to listen to do it better, because a person who knows it all cannot be taught. We have to be willing to learn in order to practice doing justly. A second characteristic, the Bible says, about doing justly is to be honest in our dealings. Be honest in our dealings. In Proverbs 20, verse 7, the just man walks in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. Perhaps some of you have seen a Norman Rockwell painting. We had the opportunity, this is years ago, to Crystal Bridges that had a big display museum of Norman Rockwell. And I didn't know, but the paintings there that show up on magazine or on covers of about 10 by 14 are actually 6 feet high and like 3 feet wide. Great big paintings. And I remember seeing this in a magazine, and I remember seeing it in person. And there was a small town meat market, and a happy butcher at the butcher shop was selling meat, had it on the scale, and he was selling it. But on the back side of the scale, you could see his thumb was on the scale, pushing the scale down to make it look like he was selling more meat than he really was, and pointing to the volume of meat that he was selling. Well, we've all been cheated a time or three in life, and we use those experiences to teach our children and grandchildren about how God's way is really a better way, where people can deal openly and honestly without fear of being ripped off. The third characteristic of a just man is they keep trying. They keep trying. In Proverbs 24, verse 16, in Proverbs 24, in verse 16, we read, "For a righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, but the wicked shall fall by calamity." Well, I hate falling down. But what does a just man do? They get up and they give it another go. They don't quit. They keep at it. It says right here, "and rises up again." So how many times in life have we wanted to give up? How many times did we think that the task in front of us was hopeless? How many times have we said, "it's just too rough. I just can't do it." But we know that we will not be handed a bigger burden than we're able to carry. Now, in Proverbs 29, verse 27, and I'm close to that one, just a page or two over, Proverbs 29, verse 27. "An unjust man is an abomination to the righteous, and he who is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked." Well, we read that one a little earlier. It's terrible when we have to deal with somebody who is unjust. But the psalmist shows that it's possible to get relief. And we read about in Psalm 43 in verse 1 about asking God to deliver us from the deceitful and unjust man. Well, if it weren't possible to obtain relief from the unjust man, then any pleading prayer to God would be in vain. We may as well throw up our hands, give up, eat worms, and die. But is it possible to obtain relief? The psalmist knew that relief was possible and sought God's help. We have the advantage of the writing of the apostles to make clear our Christian way. In John 14:14, "if you ask anything in my name, I will do it." So if our heart is right, and we're doing what we should do, and going in the right direction, we'll have God working with us. But let's not stop. That was John 14:14. Let's read the verse 15. It tells us how. "If you love me, keep my commandments." That's not a difficult principle. These principles go hand in hand. If we're to entitle, we are entitled to ask God to fulfill our needs. But by the same token, God says that if we're to love him, we will naturally want to keep his commandments. There's a difference between have to and want to. And what do we find a lot of people in the world today? They do things because they have to. But what does God expect? What is the righteous, the just person doing? Who they do it because they want to. They want to reach for the benefits and because that will accrue to them and to their family and to their neighbors and everyone else. Because they want to keep God's commandment, they know that there's a good result. There is a vivid biblical example of someone who didn't just throw up her hands and quit when she came upon an unjust man. It's demonstrated in a parable spoken by Jesus. And the parable is often entitled The Importunate Widow. It's also called the parable of the unjust judge. It's in Luke 18. And we read through Luke 18, starting in verse 1, that there was a widow, and I'll just paraphrase it. And she was seeking justice in front of, was labeled a judge, verse 2, who feared neither God nor man. In other words, he was everything to everybody. And it was the widow that said, avenge me of my adversary, verse 3. In other words, somebody has done me wrong. And I want you, the judge, which is where I need to go civilly to make it right. And the judge in verse 4 wouldn't do it for a while, but he said within himself, because I don't fear God or man, I can do what, basically, I can do whatever I want. It's just too bad. And then verse 5, because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Oh, she didn't stop. She persisted and to seek justice. And then we have this example, verses 6 and 7 and 8. Will not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night to him, even though he bears long with them? Verse 8, I will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, interestingly, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? How many people just give up? Well, I guess I did what I could, and that's it. The answer to that one is, you got a bum deal, too bad, endure. Or do we persist? Now, the widow in that time had a very low status in society. She didn't have a lot of power. And many societies around the world, even today, that's true. If we go back and read in Deuteronomy 24, widows were specifically provided for by leaving corners of the field and gleanings of the orchards so that they might harvest the crops regardless of who owned the land. And we read about that in the book of Ruth, where Ruth and her mother-in-law Naomi gleaned in the fields. So the widows were provided for in that way, in that culture. The unjust judge in this parable in Luke 18 knew he didn't have to hear the widow's complaint if he didn't want to. She had no place else to go. And he had power, and she didn't. But just as God has provided for the weak and the powerless to overcome injustice, so he provides a way for us to overcome injustice. We can follow the importunate widow's example and ask repeatedly if we must, and then have faith in God and his law. Now, a couple times we referred to Proverbs 29, verse 27, and I've quoted the first half of the verse, but I want to take a look at the second half of Proverbs 29, 27. An unjust man is an abomination to the just. And we all know the misery when somebody's unjust and they're afflicting us. And he that is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. Well, when you're doing the right thing, have you noticed that it's really irritating to those who really prefer to do the wrong thing? Whether it starts out as a schoolyard bully when you're a youngster. And I have this example, a high school example. Johnny comes over and says, a bunch of us are all skipping high school today. Bobby has a six-pack. Davey's bringing some weed, and we can ride in Freddie's car. His license is suspended, but don't worry about that. He can still drive his dad's car. Let's go. Well, if you decline the invite to those who are going to do those things, and they turn and they mock you and say, what's the matter? Are you a pansy? You afraid you're going to get caught? You're just a chicken. Bark, 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 you know, and no end of that. It happens to students. What about in the workplace? You see somebody pilfering? Well, a little bit of thievery doesn't matter. It's just a little thing. Or what about the pressures that our children, grandchildren, and coworkers face every day? The peer pressure is strong. And as we read in Proverbs 29, verse 27, it can be hard to do the right thing in the face of pressure from those who abhor God's laws. So that's about doing justly, which we talked about in Micah 6:8. The second thing is to love mercy. That's the second point. Let's turn to an example that's often used to demonstrate forgiveness. And I'm not going to read every verse in Matthew 18, verses 23 and on. But it's really about another parable about accountability. And the kingdom of God is like to a certain king who would take account of his servants. In other words, doing a review. And this is the where somebody who owed him a great deal of money, he forgave him. But that same servant went out and tried to grab everything he could for a minuscule amount from someone else, until the king found out about that and said, look, I forgave you a great amount, and you couldn't even forgive a tiny bit for someone else. So if we look long and hard while applying the parable, we realize how difficult it is to have mercy on those who have done a serious wrong to us. Yet we're called to temper justice with mercy. In Psalm 89, verse 14, justice and mercy are the habitation of my throne. Mercy and truth shall go before your face. Well, just as it's reported in, as we read in Micah 6:8, justice and mercy go hand in hand. We can compel or force justice, but we really want to be judged as harshly as we're often willing to judge others. Now, some people take this admonition to extend mercy to the absurd extreme. Notice the order of the principles in Micah 6:8. Justice comes first, then it's followed by mercy. We do not read in the Bible that we are to forego justice and simply hand out get-out-of-jail-free cards, because Satan would like us to go to that extreme. Such a libertine attitude would endorse an anything-goes society that isn't, that's not beholden to any laws. And if there's no law, then there's no justice. And for justice is a carrying out of the law, because mercy without justice is lawlessness. So it's not, in that sense, mercy follows justice. Mercy is a precious commodity. It's carefully granted. As in Micah 6:8, it says we're to love mercy, and love is a pretty strong word. Accordingly, we're to look for ways to extend mercy in such a way that it will help the person receiving mercy, not just that mercy will foster then bad behavior. Sometimes it's not merciful to let someone off the hook in the name of mercy. Do we want a serial killer to go free to go ahead and kill again? Is it merciful to the person's future victims? Well, of course not. And sometimes it's easy to grant mercy, and other times it's not an easy choice. At many years ago at my company, I had 12 to 15 employees, and every once in a while, I had a problem employee. And once I had a thief who was sneaking stuff out the door. Another time I had an incompetent clerk. Another one who just didn't understand the importance of following instructions. He was insubordinate. Another one is a bumbler, wasn't paying attention, didn't have the company's interest at heart. Then there was one girl that thought there was no problem with her wearing a miniskirt today, every day, and distracting the help and the customers. And then there was one, and this was probably the hardest, daily body odor. Ever try to correct somebody with that when they don't see any problem because they're used to it? And so over time, all of those situations, they didn't change. There was no corrective behavior. And so I had to adopt a policy. I didn't want to be harsh, but I still wanted to be merciful. So what I did was something that I've not seen before, but it worked for me. And that was, I called him in and said, you have the opportunity. I never did this on a Friday afternoon, by the way. You have an opportunity to go to work for somebody who you really want to work for at a job you really like, for an employer who you're excited to go about every day, and that you can enjoy that opportunity. So I'm going to give you that opportunity. So here's 2 weeks' pay ahead, and I want you to go down to the state employment office and file for unemployment compensation. And I want you to go find somebody that you can work with that will help you achieve your goals and that's compatible with you. And remarkable thing happened over the years, over the many years that I had that company. And in fact, I had one fellow, well, every person that I ever discharged came back later and thanked me and said, you did the right thing at the right time, and my life is better for it. I'm going, wait a minute, I just thought I would practice the right thing, how I would want to be treated if the employer was not agreeing with me. Had one fellow, his work performance went down. He had been with me several years, and his work performance faded away. And we talked about it, but it just didn't get any better. And I finally gave him the opportunity to go find another employer. He came back to visit a year later and thanked me, and he said, "You changed my life." He said, "You did not know it, but I had become an alcoholic. And I never drank on the job, but," he said, "I drank like a fish when I was off of work. And it degraded his work performance. I mean, all I saw was the degraded work performance." And he came back after a year. He had gone to a clinic, found a related job in the industry, and was just thankful that that had turned the corner for him. It was several years later that I hired him back. And he became my right-hand man, because now I could trust him. He was well experienced, knew what he was doing. And then when we sold the company and I moved away, he called me up and said, "I want to start my own business. Will you help me?" So on the telephone and the fax machine, we worked together, and he developed a similar thriving business over the years. That, in other words, not throwing people away, but extending mercy at the same time doing justice to your company and so forth. Didn't make me a great guy. I was just practicing the principles that we read. The third characteristic in Micah 6:8 is to walk humbly with our God. Well, we read that it's important to do justly and to love mercy. Now, we know that we read earlier that Isaiah said the importance of holiness, setting apart by God for a special purpose. So for us to be at one with God, to be truly holy, we really have to be humble. Because what good is it to do justly and be arrogant about it? What is it to say, "Look at me, I'm doing everything right, and you're not," is the implication. Or, "Look at me, I'm applying mercy, and you're not, so therefore I am the superior being." It says, To do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before your God. If you call attention to those things, you miss the point. It's not, you're missing the humility point. In Luke 18, in verse 9, talks about a parable that Jesus spoke. In Luke 18, verse 9 and after, a parable unto which people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. "Well, look how good I am," kind of thing. And he gives the example of the two people went up to pray, the Pharisee and a publican. Now, the Pharisee was prided themselves for being righteous to the nth degree, and the publican was a widely despised person known to take bribes, a tax collector. In verse 11, the Pharisee prayed, "Thank God that I'm not as other men." And he gives a list of sins. "I fast twice in the week, I give tithes." And yet the publican, the tax collector, standing afar off, wouldn't even lift his eyes up and said, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." So what does Jesus say? Which one went to his house more justified than the other? You can't do, you can't just do justly and love mercy and brag about it, make a big show, and then don't you really miss the point? Is it calling attention how often we fast or pray or how righteous we are? Is that really a loving and respectful thing? And in 1 Corinthians 13, the chapter starts out that though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not charity or love, I become as a sounding brass or tinkling cymbal. So if we toot our horn as to how righteous or humble we are, then the verse says we're just making noise. Now, I'm not a musician, but I know the difference between music and noise, okay? And so that's what it sounds like to God. It isn't It isn't pleasant music. It's noise. And somehow, people misconstrue God's instructions in all three areas of Micah 6:8. What does the Eternal require of us but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God? I want you to notice it does not say suggest. It doesn't say recommend. It doesn't say ask us to consider. This is an imperative. These three points are expected of us. And fortunately, like all of God's instructions, they are for our lasting benefit. Sometimes when we read over the Bible verses, we're quick to apply verses to someone else. So God says to do justly, so we immediately project that on other people. We expect them to do justly for us, especially to us. The commandment actually says for us to do justly to others. That doesn't mean that others will reciprocate and do justly to us. In fact, our life experience has taught us what? Doing justly is really the exception instead of the rule. That we humans often expect justice of others without necessarily doing it ourselves. People also expect the other guy to show mercy on them, but they're busy themselves less willing to show mercy on the other guy. Well, God expects us to do justly, but to act in a balanced way to show mercy. And if we manage to do justly and love mercy, then the challenge for all of us is to learn to walk humbly with our God. It was 13 years ago, a dear old friend died. Leonard Scriber was once a minister of mine 40 years ago, and I remember the first year he was a feast coordinator, a Feast of Tabernacles coordinator in Eugene, Oregon. And I was working on the 24-hour communications team. There were, what, about 4,500 people at that feast. And Mr. Scriber made it clear to all the department heads and other volunteers it was their job to make their job look easy. He said, if we're all relaxed and approached every situation in a calm and relaxed manner, we would then radiate a good sense of comfort, and that would extend out during the feast. And he said that was the importance of being a humble servant. And if somebody made a mistake, he allowed them to correct it without making a big deal about it. And I will long remember Mr. Scriber as a man who practiced Micah 6:8. Well, today we've looked from the 8th century BC, history around the time of the prophets, Isaiah, Hosea, Amos, and Micah. We saw how Micah focused on the principles spoken by Isaiah, Amos, and Hosea. And we looked at the examples of unjust people in everyday lives. And throughout history, we had a brief overview of some of the markedly unjust men on earth. We've looked at the lives of people mentioned in the Bible as being just men and why they were considered just. And we've looked at other scripture to get a more complete understanding of what does it take to be a just man. We explored the biblical teaching of mercy, and we saw that justice tempered with mercy must be accompanied with humility in our walk with God. So Micah 6:8, what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God.